Hello and welcome to the Negroni Talks podcast, brought to you from East London and supported by Campari. Set up to be lively, provocative debates on issues around architecture and organised by Architects for the Space with the assistance of Rob Fain, the talks are designed to emulate the opinionated and convivial free-flowing debates found in the Fin de Siècle European Café Society, being fuelled by food, drink and particularly Negroni. There's no stage, no standing on ceremony, and the audience are asked to participate as much as invited speakers and the chair for the event. These recordings are presented as they happen live, and like the talks themselves, with no frills and little or no editing, to bring you the arguments of the evening, direct and unfiltered.
Thank you very much, Helen.
Thanks you. This is my first one of these, so I'm learning. But I've prepared a preamble to set the tone for the debate, and then I'm going to introduce each of our expert speakers. So the Museum of London and Bastion House at London Wall were designed by Powell and Moyer and built in the 1970s to wrap around Ironmongers Hall, part of the post-war rebuilding of the City of London. Neither are protected, but both form part of the wider... Now the museum has moved out and Bastion House is empty. The City of London Corporation wants to demolish both to make way for a development double the size. The corporation says the existing buildings are no longer viable. The greener option would be to rebuild. And one report, it claimed that the 17-storey Bastion House was about to fall down. Heritage campaigners and the pressure group Barbican Quarter Action say those claims are nonsense. They argue that both could be kept, refitted and repurposed, and that to demolish them would amount to carbon crimes, given the amount of embodied carbon within their fabric. Like Marks & Spencer's plan to demolish its Oxford Street store, London Wall has become a test case for the argument that old buildings should be repurposed for the sake of carbon embodied in their fabric and to avoid the costs of the carbon involved in rebuilding. From the Ringway Centre in Birmingham to Norco House in Aberdeen to the Assembly Rooms in Derby, the same protracted fights between developers and conservationists are playing out. So can the emblematic battle for Bastion House be won? Joining us are our eminent speakers. We have Ruth Lang, who is over there. Ruth is an architect, writer, curator, and the lead for low carbon housing at the Design Museum's Future Observatory, researching barriers to reducing embodied carbon in the house building industry. We've also got Tyler Goodwin. Tyler. Tyler is founder and CEO of Seaforth Land, the development company behind the refurbishment of the 1968 Space House, just off Kingsway, among others. Tyler has worked in global real estate for 30 years in the US, Asia, and Europe, and he has a deep knowledge and understanding of sovereign and institutional real estate investors. We've got Robert Elms, writer and broadcaster, known for his long-running radio show on BBC Radio London and a fairly new Barbican resident. And finally, we've got Jan Mark Petroschka, director of Petroschka Architects and part of the Barbican Quarter Action Group. Welcome, everybody. So I'm going to start with an opening question to Jan Mark. Where is the campaign at now?
The planning application for London Wall West was submitted in November. The consultation period has been extended to 6th of April, and the scheme is going to committee on the 17th of April. So very short consultation period ends. We've had 700 objections so far, and are working on other options if we don't manage to get this application rejected. Judicial review, get it called in. Firstly, we're also working on getting it called in by the mayor. And then by the Secretary of State.
Okay, I'm going to ask Ruth Lang. Ruth, can any building be retrofitted and repurposed?
I mean, that's a really interesting question because it has a kind of twofold answer in that, yes, of course, you could retrofit any building. For what purpose and whether that is economically viable, I think is like a different question maybe altogether. I think as we've seen with the M&S at Oxford Street famously, there are certain agendas that are being set that are being exercised through the intention to demolish that building. And a lot of justification, which is about trying to create spaces that people want. And I don't know, of the kind of arguments that have been put forward to say we need department stores that have higher floor to ceilings. Has anyone here actually been asked what floor to ceilings you want for department stores? Because it... Have you? Okay, just checking. I was like, I'm completely undermining my argument in the first moment. Because a lot of these agendas have been set by what has happened in the past, and we have been designing and procuring buildings on old forms of models for a long time, economically, socially, culturally. And something we found through the research we're doing at the Design Museum, and specifically looking at house building, is saying what the market demands. And I think the idea of the market is what's been sold, and that's the only kind of statistics we can work on. So what we're basically saying is that we're demolishing this building because previously there is a different model that's been set. How do we start setting an agenda for something that says we would like to retain that? Like, as a public, we need to be able to advocate for the fact that we want this retained. And then looking at the kind of like technical aspect of how the architectural profession, which needs to be reshaped to accommodate differences in times for the delivery of projects, different kinds of collaboration, thinking about how surveys and like listening to building historians and thinking about like what's valuable to be stripped, what's valuable to be kept versus what is able to be discarded, what needs to be stripped away in order to accommodate new forms, is about basically saying like, yes, whatsoever, but what do we need to change before we need to get there? And I think there's quite some fundamental questions of not only the architectural profession, but everything that is architecture adjacent as well.
Thank you. Robert, give us a sense of how the proposed development might affect the cultural and residential life of, and the integrity of the Barbican.
Okay. I think I'm unusual here as a Barbican resident. In the one of the things that has slightly disappointed and amazed me since moving into the Barbican, I've been there 2.5 years. It's just how NIMBY many of the Barbican people are. They are the grumpiest group of people I've ever encountered. For people who live in a, you know, a radical modernist development, they don't like anything new, anything modern, anything radical. So can I just say that straight away? So I'm not one of those people who says, no, we can't do anything new. You mustn't redevelop it and that. And I do think there's a real feeling of that among some of the Barbican residents. My preferred plan for something like Bastion House would be to open the back door and let squatters in. I would have architects and planners nowhere near it, because I think the best things come from the ground below rather than being imposed on from above. But unfortunately, we're talking about the City of London Corporation, which is probably not going to let that happen.
Probably not.
Probably not. So for me, the big battle here is not about, let's face it, is it a great building? No. The Barbican's a great building. It's a good building. It's a decent building. I don't think it's the Barbican, personally. What sort of city do we want to live in? What are its usages rather than just what its physical structure is? It was originally proposed to be a concert hall, which I always thought was a rather elitist notion, to be honest. I'd like social housing in there more than anything else, because I think it's what that area needs most. I would like some sort of cultural development, but does it have to be something as quite as kind of high culture as a concert hall? No. I think what we got to find is some kind of compromise that says the City of London has to be a place for people to live in, people to play in, people to enjoy, and if we need some office space, fine. But it's become a kind of 100% on one side. City of London 100% want their towers of Babel. The residents 100% want to keep this building. I slightly find the green element slightly spurious. I think they've latched on to that as a way of trying to say, we don't want your building. That's how I feel at this moment in time. I think we have to find some kind of compromise that says that space there should be for all of us, not just another not very good office tower, which is what they're proposing.
Tyler, you've been to look at Space House and its possibilities. You've already developed...
You mean Bastion House.
Bastion House, yeah. You've already developed Space House. You've been to look at Bastion House. Can you give us a sense of the market? Can you give me a sense of how much this is being dictated by a rush for premium office space?
Sure. Maybe first I'll start by saying, because some of the things I'm going to say are not going to be popular. But also I'll start by giving a little bit of background on my credentials as a developer that's actually concerned about the built environment. Space House is a 1968 designed by George Marsh and Richard Seifert. That is going to be the first BREEAM outstanding grade 2 listed building in the UK. We were told for years that wouldn't be possible. It's really about creating something that's really unique and giving that building another 60 years. And we do care about the built environment. We've got a building at the Wingate in Soho that is where some of you will know the Curzon Cinema. For those that fought the Curzon, we did save the Curzon. That building is not listed. We followed the same methodology and approach in treating it like it was a listed building. And recycling the building. We've got two other buildings that we've recycled, repurposed. One of them is at Bleeding Heart Yard, which was a 1971, I swear a lot, so I'll apologize in advance, a brick shit house of a building that sat up on the hill on Greville Street as you came out of Farringdon Station. And that building was redesigned. The entire existing envelope was repurposed, so we've kept that whole retained structure, and with the Mintaha have come up with a beautiful building that's been recognized and won a bunch of awards. And to your point, Ruth, right? Yeah, that's a great example of a building that most people said was not fit for purpose. And that building last year, we sold it at the worst time in the market, a market where for every 10 buildings that were brought to market, only 4 would sell. And that sold at the highest price per square foot of any building in the city. So that shows that you can create something special out of recycling a building. I also spoke at and against the developer, the Marks and Spencer site at the Tribunal, conservation of Orchard House, which didn't make me any friends, but as you guys can probably tell, I'm not from here, so I couldn't give a shit. I'm Canadian. I've lived here for 10 years, but I will speak my mind. And Robert, I'm really glad that you've raised this point about NIMBYs, because and I'm close friends with people on the conservation side, because I do sincerely care about conservation. But I think we all need to recognize that my mom used to say, you get more bees with honey than you do with vinegar. And the fact is, if you're only ever wielding the stick, you're going to stop having a voice. And that's the problem right now, is that nobody's listening. We don't care. The industry doesn't care. Because all you do is say you don't want it, right? This is a beautiful building. I actually think it's a beautiful building. People know I did submit a proposal. It was meant to be confidential, but apparently it was leaked. And our proposal was to recycle the building, because I think it should be recycled. It's a cool building, all right? It's actually, it could be a spectacular building, but not at any cost. And the right decision, if I would pick two areas in the city that are in desperate need of change, it's Upper Thames and it's London Wall West. It's terrible. The streetscape, the experience is terrible. It is the antithesis of what we should want in the built environment. It's a complete failure. And for some reason, people are arguing to save it. It makes absolutely no sense. I will walk an extra 10 minutes to go around London Wall West, literally. And so, unfortunately, what could have happened, and I believe, yes, it may be out for public consultation or you know, for review still, but I believe that the opportunity on Bastion House has passed, and that's unfortunate. That doesn't make me popular, but again, remember what I said earlier. But the fact is, and I think it's really important, if we can learn how to find compromise, if you really cared about the conservation of this building, and that was really a priority and not stopping construction, you would have said, we want to save Bastion House. How do we find compromise? And I think that's the problem with where we are today is, unfortunately, the all or none has just ended up in a none scenario, which is sad because I think this could be a pretty cool building if it were done right.
Okay, so I'm going to throw... taking it that most people here will have seen the renderings for the proposed development by... So there's three towers by the London architectural firm Shepherd Robson, and the New York practice Diller, Scafido and Renfro have proposed all the green areas around the new development. Does anyone have any views on how realistic all those trees are that are lining those balconies? Does anyone have any views on the proposals themselves, on the renderings?
Well, firstly, I want to clarify, we are not in favour of keeping the building in Aspic as it is. There are many things that are wrong with Bastion House. The idea of the high walks was never continued. There's a huge problem with access, for example. The whole streetscape doesn't work today. But it doesn't mean that you have to demolish the building. You know, the building industry is responsible for 62% of waste. That's huge fungus. 15% of CO2 is emitted by new construction. We can reduce that by maintaining, keeping the building. It doesn't mean that you have to have a scalpel. You have to, like a doctor, you have to look at this building very carefully, what the ills are, where you have to cut away, and like a Renaissance man or Renaissance woman, you then add to the building to create a perfect building, new building again, but working with the existing buildings. The building works very hard on a very difficult site with the ironmongers in the middle. It follows the orthogonal grid of the Barbican estate, laid out post-war. It follows the streets, and then like a jewel, it keeps the ironmongers hall at its center. The ironmongers hall was much smaller when it actually was built, the Museum of London. What this scheme now proposed doesn't do at all, it doesn't react to the actual context it sits within. It could be in Las Vegas, could be in Los Angeles, anywhere, but it shouldn't be here. It doesn't pay any attribute or any homage to the rectangular grid of the Barbican. You have two massive bulbous buildings in the middle that do not relate in scale, in material, to anything that's around. And then they have I'm outraged when I saw it the first time, that they actually dare to put a 14-story tower in the middle of a Roman road that's been there for 1,600 years. I mean, shame on you. That's architecture, urban vandalism, what they're doing. What they have done, they have extruded the site boundaries. They had a daylight and sunlight analysis to see how much they can get away with. Then they had long-distance view from Hungerford Bridge, from Waterloo Bridge, and to see how much they can get away with St. Paul's and St. Bride's in the background. And that determines the shape of the building, not the immediate context. It's outrageous. It's urbanism done by accountants and not by architects. So that is why the proposal is fundamentally flawed.
Does anyone like it? Does anyone have anything good to say about it?
I don't know if I'm going to say something good about it. I just want to say, full disclaimer, I think Bastion House is amazing. I love it. I think it's a very, I don't know, sensual building. Something about it is really interesting. But just wanted to pick up on something that you said about responding to context. When London Wall was built, after that bit was, you know, that bit of the city was totally flattened during the war, there was a row of 18-storey curtain-walled buildings. So some of the first curtain wall buildings in the country. So something about modern ideas, not necessarily responding to context. So just on a point, need to, like, the buildings that are there don't necessarily, the ones that we're arguing to save don't necessarily respond to context. So it's just a bit of a provocation, basically.
Does anyone have any other observations about the proposals? Are they, they're very green, for example. And that's an area of the city where there isn't a lot of green space.
Yeah, apart from the trees, which you touched upon, I always find it I feel a little bit sorry for trees that are taken away from their home. I've looked at it. I've been teaching this site, or talking about this site, with students at the design workshop in housing and urbanism at the AA. And we try to position ourselves in the adaptive reuse kind of argument and try to understand where there's value on what's existing and so forth. Just going back to the students, you know, there will be some arguments that, yeah, it sorts out that thing that Tyler was alluding to, that kind of pretty grim streetscape that you have, and they've taken efforts to address that. But then you've got this whole greenwash kind of corridor in kind of very urban setting. And the complexity and the richness and the active ground doesn't really sort of come across well with the proposals. In so much, you tend to get cynical with it in respect to how quickly you're into kind of lettable square foot or space that is ultimately for sale. But the thing that I notice most of all with the new development, and I can't understand this, and maybe someone like Tyler can help explain it, is that I did some ballpark figures on the construction cost of the proposed development. Those ballpark figures were very cautious, and I was looking at, well, could cost around about 60 million to build. And then I looked at the potential high-end values there are in the city in terms of, you know, the rents and also the sale foot of commercial office space, and the figures don't add up. They don't add up at all. What does add up, going back to what Robert was saying, is that 50 units of housing and a good chunk of affordable would work on that site. But the amount of office area against the construction cost of that building doesn't add up financially on that kind of simple developer kind of led thing. So obviously there's value in its attraction in the city, its attraction as maybe a kind of signature building, or perhaps a billboard for a larger company, or an investment that kind of carries a yield for over 10, 20 years where it does become valuable, because it's very difficult to ascertain value in regards to the proposed development at the moment.
Tyler, do you want to expand on that?
Yeah, I'll touch on construction costs especially. I've got a bit of experience in that. So we've got, well, over the last 3 years, we've been delivering 600,000 square feet to the market between 2020 and 2023, you had plant and equipment, the BCIS index, up by 50%. Construction materials up by 40%. We've had interest rates blow up. And nothing makes sense anywhere. Construction costs don't make sense. I guess that, and it's not a silly question here, but who here cares about developers making profit? Put up your hands. Like, is this a priority? Right? It's crocodile tears. Who cares? Guess what? You don't get anything if you don't let developers make a profit. I actually, what? Thank you. Hold on a second. Let me finish. Let me finish my point. No, because just one second. Because my job is to go out and raise institutional capital and deliver returns on their investment. And if I can't show them, if I can't prove that it's feasible, that money's not going to come. All right? And you can't tell me, you can get it from other sources. You can go to the government and say, government should build that. And you should, because that's your other option.
Yeah, because this is about political will.
It is. You're absolutely right.
One can either say it has to rely upon profit, or one can say this is what we need and how do we find ways to fund that, which is what we did throughout the complete post-war rebuilding of Britain, whereby we put social housing as our priority, for example. You wouldn't have built the Golden Lane estate, you know, half a mile from there, if profit were your criteria. So
I agree with you, but if you want... The point is, if you want to wholly rely on government to deliver...
I do.
Okay. Good luck with that. Because, okay. By the way, let's talk about that for a minute, because housing... Who agrees housing's in an absolute crisis mode right now? All right? Who doesn't agree? All right? Honestly. For those of you that didn't put your hands up, shame on you. No, just kidding.
Let me
just... Because this is really relevant... Housing construction is down, housing starts are down 74% on 10 years ago. Housing completion down 63%. All right? Not only that, rents last year were up 9.9%. Rents the year before were up 17%. Gen Z and millennials today represent 55% of office-based employment. In the next 6 years, it's going to 68%, more than two-thirds. Millennials, almost 30%, have already resigned. It's not like they want to be Generation Rent, resigned to being Generation Rent. All right? And now we're talking about it going to 68%, and government can't deliver, is failing to deliver.
Government chooses not to deliver.
Maybe. You could. I mean, I don't think any politician would say, I choose to create this shit show.
Well, I don't know. We privatized housing under Thatcher and have never gone back on that process. Privatizing housing, when I was growing up on a council estate, 43% of people living in Inner London lived in social housing. We made a decision collectively or politically, or Thatcher made that decision to privatize that sector. It's been the worst of all the privatizations.
I mean, we can undo that. I mean, maybe that's the solution, but do you really think it's going to happen?
No.
Okay, so let's try to stay in reality and try to, like, because the problem here is the math isn't working for residential. Meanwhile, policies continue to expand and make it even more. Boroughs where, I mean, all we do is refurb. All I want to do is more sustainable, conscientious refurb. And I'm having a hard time making money. Like, on Bleeding Heart Yard, we sold it at £1,600 a foot. Guess how much money I made? Zero. I built that for 5.5 years. I made no money. Celebrating what a great success it is. Makes it pretty hard for me to raise money to do the next project. Meanwhile, this borough has just come out with a new policy. Yeah, we really want to see refurbishment. Oh, by the way, 20% of your building... refurb, not additional square footage, should go in for affordable. So now I have to deliver 20%. I have to hand over So 20% of it goes at 50% of market value. So now, like, I'm already not making money. So what am I doing this for? Like, for charity? That's what's happening in the office market right now. So the math, you're absolutely right. It doesn't make sense. The city is the one exception where actually they're trying to make the math work, but unfortunately interest rates are so high that you can't even make the math work in the city. There are a number of schemes that have been approved where the developers are fearful of pushing the button on starting it.
So there's...
Sorry, just to come in. One thing.
Could I ask you to say your name? Sorry,
yeah, my name's Steve. And
who you work for and what your...
Yeah, I was introduced early by Hugh, but we didn't get to meet earlier on, Helen. So I just wanted to say one thing to follow up on what Tyler was saying, and then I think, Neil, you had something to say. Sorry, Helen. Is that on this question of value and getting the best return for the City of London, Chris Hayworth, who's one of the Hayward, head of policy at City of London, has quite clearly stated that it's in the City of London's best interest, or legally, it's in their requirements to maximise the gain of any given site. But they're not doing it with the proposed development.
So there's a question down here. Could you say your name and...
the person you were talking to or not?
Yeah, there's someone, okay. So we'll go one, two. Yeah.
Okay. I'm Neil Dealey, I'm an architect, and I feel slightly to blame in a very, very small way for the conversation about Baston House, because in 2014... when we were looking for things to do, we came up with the idea of approaching the City of London to see if they were interested in the thought that the Museum of London could be moved to Smithfield Market, to the general market. And we went to see the surveyors, and thinking that we might last about 10 minutes in the room, an hour and a half later, they were still saying, well, how would this work then? So we demonstrated that the Museum of London could be moved to Smithfield Market. And then that idea began to happen. And I think a few points of context around Baston House. One is that the City of London are moving Museum of London to Smithfield Market. And I mean, that is something I think that they should be applauded for, because it's saving the heritage of the market. It's going to breathe amazing life, cultural life, into that part of Smithfield that desperately needs it. We're based in and have been based in Clerkenwell for the last 20 years, and the market's definitely had its day, and we all know that. And I think the city needs to be congratulated for buying the market, or that part. Okay. So
I would rather the market stayed there, and I think many of the people who work there would.
Okay. No. Well. Okay. Well. Okay. Well. That's that's a good point of view. I think that if anyone's sort of been around the market, you can see the market is really fading. Anyway, that's another conversation. That's another. Okay, anyway, maybe that's another sort of topic of debate for this evening. That's topic of debate.
Have you finished?
So anyway, I mean, the point I wanted to make really was that there's a much bigger picture here, which is I think the corporation is trying to do, you might not agree the right thing in trying to breathe new life into the museum, breathe new life into the derelict end and the end that they abandoned of Smithfield Market. And then they've obviously generated a development site with the vacant land, but there is obviously a much bigger picture here. Whether they're doing the right thing, I disagree that they're doing the right thing with Museum of London site and Baston House. I think a much more interesting scheme could have come forward that was in the spirit and saw itself as part of the Barbican estate in a way that the scheme doesn't. It could have fixed that corner. It could have done all sorts of wonderful things for the estate itself, and it doesn't do that. But I think it's difficult to talk about Baston House in isolation without thinking about this much bigger picture that's going on, whether or not everyone agrees with that bigger picture.
There's another comment down there at the far end.
My name's Anne Page. I live in the Barbican in Cromwell Tower. I'm not normally conservative in the sense that one wants to keep everything leave aside politically. But I just want to say on the London Wall West, a few points that haven't yet been made. First of all, the city corporation is the applicant and it is the giver of, it's the owner of the site, it's the applicant and it's the giver of planning permission. And it seems to me that is quite wrong on a major development. There should be a system for taking that outside the hands of, one element should be outside the hands of the corporation. Secondly, we've had no needs analysis. There's never been a serious statement about why so many extra square feet of office space is required, leave aside at London Wall West. I'm fortunate enough to have an easterly view from Cromwell Tower across the square mile, and I can see acres and acres of empty office space. And I would like to see a serious argument for need, given what we now know about future working patterns and how much longer are we going to imagine people coming back into full-time office work when they've got used to different ways of working.
Has anyone got any observations on office vacancy rates? I was doing some digging. McKinsey predicts that demand for office space will remain below pre-pandemic levels for decades, with at least 26% drop in the value by 2030 in big cities around the world. So that's globally, and that includes London. Office vacancy rates are at their highest since 2000 in London, and they're predicted to go much higher. Goldman Sachs estimates the price might have to fall by almost 50% before conversions could become financially viable. Does anyone have any expertise on how financially viable it might be to convert offices into homes? Ruth, are you able to comment on that?
I mean, I don't want to say it. Let somebody else talk, and then I'm happy to add.
I mean, you said economically, but I think there's also a bigger issue about social change between office buildings and, like, let's just bung a load of housing into it, about, like, the quality of that housing that has been delivered under permitted development rights and the fact that it has been proven so far to be absolutely catastrophic. Like, if we are going to do something like that, there's got to be some kind of space standards that are involved and ideas about the quality of space that's being instigated through overstretched planning resources already, or even like building regulations or something, which is taking into account not virgin builds, but about how we reuse existing buildings and therefore like what you can accommodate within that. And there are so many issues that we have about particularly residential, like fire escapes, especially after Grenfell and the new Building Act that's come in, which are really difficult to negotiate. And I think everyone's really like nervous about having to confront that and finding that they fail. So having more support and more kind of sharing of resources, sharing knowledge, like showing you each other's workings rather than kind of like squirreling away and like saying this is our special knowledge and we're not going to share it with anyone. Like there isn't any lead from REBA, there isn't any lead from ARB or from planning authorities to support people in trying to convert buildings in a good way. And so we really need to rethink, rather than saying, like, well, this is what we've been trained in, because if you are an architect, you probably have been taught how to design new builds, looking very specifically at LSA students who are not, and therefore challenging some of these things, but maybe you have. So there is a kind of rethink that needs to happen if we are to and we can't just say, although it's the perfect site for social housing. We need more housing within London. We need more affordable housing within London, whether that is an economic model which can be employed and where the funding needs to come from, I think is a bigger question. And as Tyler's picked up, we can't expect government to lead that. And that is the really heartbreaking thing at the moment. So what other models are there available? And maybe this is a point at which I hand over to Tyler.
Thanks, okay. We'll talk, let me cover office utilization rates first, because that's quite important. Office utilization rates are the rate of it. It's not vacancy rate. Vacancy rate in the city of, across central London is 9%. That includes a bullshit number out of Canary Wharf that says vacancy rate's 15%. So that's live streamed. I'm going to get in trouble for that. But that's the purpose of that is that there's a lot of the definition of vacancy rate is landlord-controlled space available for lease plus tenant-controlled space available for lease. And Canary Wharf isn't fully reporting the tenant-controlled space available for lease. But the rest of London, it's a robust number. So let's call the vacancy rate, true vacancy rate, ex Canary Wharf, 8%. All right? Arguably. Utilization rates pre-COVID, before this whole work-from-home phenomena has really pushed in and hybrid working, was 65%. And that's in line with it being a regional headquarters. There are a lot of people, like a Goldman Sachs banker is expected to be on the road 3 days of the week. They still get office space, but they're not always at their office. So utilization rate pre-COVID was 65%. It's now 60. So it's come back compared to New York, which is 45 to 50%, San Francisco, which is 30, 35%. So utilization rates are already back to close to pre-COVID levels. And that, I would argue, even though we haven't watched it carefully, actually, office-based employment has risen by 300,000 people since prior to COVID. So if you add, multiply 300,000 square feet or 300,000 people times 10 meters, which is the British Council for Office Density, standard density for office space, 10 meters per square per person, that is approximately 30 million square feet of new demand. Vacancy rose, but that was demand that should have materialized, that really didn't. That is an example of structural loss. What we've also seen is densification in a post-WeWork world reversing. So all of you that are in design and architecture are talking to their tenants and their customers, and they're saying, no, it's no longer 1 per 8 or 1 per 7. It's 1 per 10 to 12. So the BCO standard has moved from 8 to 10 square meters per employee to 10 to 12. So that reversal is, you could argue, on close to 3 million employees in central London, call it another 30 million square feet of demand that should have materialized that hasn't. So those two elements, plus the rise in vacancy, is the structural decline in demand as a result of hybrid working. So it is happening, but actually, vacancy rate, or we're now at its new equilibrium. There are a lot of B-grade office buildings, though. We're talking about A-grade buildings. There are a lot of B-grade buildings that are not fit for purpose, where landlords are suffering, where they're paying vacant rates, where lenders are saying we don't want to lend on it anymore, and tenants are moving out. And there is a sort of threshold relationship between rents and converting that what you can pay for an office building. Under the permitted development rights, the rules have changed. Homes England have introduced minimum lumen values, because obviously some of you will remember a few years ago, people were building windowless units. It was terrible. But now there's minimum requirements on storage, minimum size unit size, like a single occupancy is 37, a double occupancy is 39 for a studio. And so there are much higher standards that were introduced in response to the permitted development rate disaster that existed before. And the economics are starting to make sense. And this is, I think, perhaps the only solution, because it can be done quickly. You can convert an office building into a residential building, if it's vacant, under permitted development rights in 12 to 18 months. While we have an election, we have a new government, and whatever they're going to do, it's not going to happen quickly. It never has. Everybody talks about planning reform. It's just unlikely to happen. So there is a solution to deliver housing in the meantime, and I do think it is permitted development rights done right with institutional capital that is focused on delivering affordable rental. It doesn't have to be affordable with a capital A, but lower cost, no frills. These young people don't need gyms. They don't need like health clubs and all of this shit. They just need a quality place that they can rely on to live, that they can walk to work or a short commute to work, and where we can return the city to a 15-minute city. That's it.
So we've got a comment there, and then Robert, I'll go to you.
Interjection.
Could you say your name?
My name tonight is Garth. Permitted development rights, as I understand it, do not apply in the City of London. You need to go for full planning permission. So that's a problem.
No, there are actually across the city, there's this element called Article 4. Article 4 restriction is a map. In London, everything is subject to an Article 4 restriction. It's like Mayfair, subject to an Article 4. Soho, a blanket Article 4. There are areas where the view is, look, there's enough demand for offices that we don't need to convert it into residential.
Yeah. They have dispensation. They've actually got a separate dispensation from the government not to develop.
It is. It's a article. The restriction is referred to central activity zone. It's a map. We've actually combined every single map from every single borough and stitched it together, so we know every borough what the Article 4 exemption is. But you're absolutely right. In London, the only way you can convert offices into residential is to take it through the planning process. Yeah.
Can I just do my rant? My name's James Soon. I'm an architect and a teacher. But I think we're listening to the dying arguments of a neoliberal capitalist model. And we are in a climate emergency. And here's a fact that I learned today. 240 billion square meters of new build are expected by 2060. That is like printing the footprint of New York every month. Think about the carbon. This is an ethical question. It's bigger than Bastion House. It's bigger than the City of London. We have to take responsibility that everything we build is an extractive project. And we have to reverse that trend. We cannot be in the throes of a system which only demands growth and the fetish for newness. And this is, I think, a much bigger question, and I think we have to talk about it.
But who's arguing against that here? I'm not. Everything I've done is refurb. Who is arguing against doing refurb in this room? It's not.
There's clever words here, but the point being is that the Bastion House itself is a site that is contentious, and there are many options available, but the market is demanding something which is not appropriate in so many ways, and I think.
Sorry. When you say the market, what does that mean?
Well, I think that
does
we're.
Does that mean people, or does that mean?
No. I think what I'm trying to confront is the
what
argument.
What is truthfully necessary for the people to progress?
I don't. Some more housing,
I
would suggest.
To do with developers, and I think that's just true.
Well, I think we should hear from somebody in the Barbican, please.
Well, I'm in the Barbican.
Great.
And I've already said a few things, but what for me the biggest issue here is what sort of city do we want to live in? What's our city for? Is it to make money out of? Is it for profit? Well, I would hope so. And it would seem to me that the argument about Smithfield is actually the big one. My big worry about Bastion House is if the City of London Corporation can do whatever they want with that site, they can then do whatever they want with all the sites around it. And the big prize is Smithfield. If that goes, and I'd rather it didn't, but it looks like it will, if that goes as a meat market, and I would rather Covent Garden was still a market and Spitalfields was still a market, because I'm old enough to remember them and how much they were important for the character of our city. And the character of that area is so determined by Smithfield Market, and the fact that blokes with bloody white coats on still lump bits of meats about all night makes it very special. The big grab is what happens there next. Do we turn that into another money-making scheme? Does that become the next Covent Garden? Do we need another Covent Garden? No, we don't. We need something that's much more for the people of this city rather than, you know, to flog tat to tourists. So this, for me, the big issue is about who is this stuff for? Is it for speculators doing their sums? Or is it for the people who live all around there or live in this city? So to live in, to enjoy, and to be part of their lives. That's the bigger question than how many dollars you can make per square foot. Surely.
Is there a sense here that modernism is particular, and buildings of that era are particularly vulnerable in this scenario? Because if we've got office vacancy rates that are high, if we've got tenants that only want A-grade brand new builds or top-grade refurbishments of the kind that Tyler does, that leads a lot of B and C-grade office buildings, which are probably going to be 50 or 60 years old. Does the 20th Century Society have a view on that?
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. They pose... Oh, sorry. Hi, I'm Coco. I'm a caseworker at the 20th Century Society, and we're a charity that campaigns for modern heritage. Yeah, I think there's definitely... Modern buildings pose specific challenges, which make retrofit challenging, and yeah, they suffer from that. I think there are a lot of architects in the room, and I think the way we've been talking about this site at Museum of London and Bastion House is viewing a new build. The fact that this is a site of massive historic and cultural significance. The whole area was completely destroyed by bombing, and this was part of a very comprehensive scheme to rebuild this part of the city in the post-war period. And I think that it feels like recent history now, but it's actually has this massive sort of historic importance. And it's we feel that it's our responsibility to conserve buildings like this for future generations. So yeah, that's right.
What would be lost? Can you give us a sense of what would be lost if we were to lose Bastion House and the Museum of London?
I think it's partly a story. It's the story of the city's rebuilding and the way that architects and planners approached that at the time. But it's also the buildings themselves. We've talked about them being like maybe not as great as the Barbican. But I think they were doing very different things, and they were very much, particularly Bastion House, is very much of its time. It's this kind of Mie van der Rohe inspired curtain-walled office building. And I mean, those kind of buildings in the city are becoming increasingly rare. They're being demolished all the time. And I think we'd lose that architectural heritage as well as the kind of the story of the City of London in the post-war period.
So there is a precious heritage there.
Can I just add shortly? Hi, I'm Sai or Sally, depending on where we meet. I study architecture, but I'm here first and foremost because Pau and Moya are my favorite 20th century architects. And I think for me, the value of keeping Bastion House and the Museum of London is that it's a part of their legacy. And I think in today's world, it's really important to remember people like them who were not just talented architects in their own right, but also they had these great ambitions and hopes and dreams for the society that they served. And I think if we were to just carelessly get rid of buildings that supported these ambitions and replace them with, you know, tower blocks like the proposal, which are these fiercely non-contextual, and I think buildings shouldn't be that way. I think, you know, I'm in my final year currently and, you know, just about to graduate, but what about the students that come after? Are we to leave them with a built environment that is so innate and speaks to none of these things that people used to work for, and which I think architecture really should be about? Architecture should serve the people. But then, you know, when it comes to what's left for the future generation, are we just to leave them, other students, just nothing of the sort to look at, only pictures and journals and books? I don't think that's the world we should have.
Can you give us a sense of what... You're obviously an expert on Powell and work. Can you give us a sense of what their purpose was in both of those buildings? You mentioned that they had specific purposes.
Well, I think for one thing, the way they tackled the museum and Bastion House, because it was a very specific site that they had to deal with, and the buildings are the way they are because of the site they were given. Whether you think it's successful or not is up to you and your personal experience with it. But I think for me, what's important to recognize that regardless of what you think is that it was a valiant effort, and we can look back on it from so many decades after as a source, obviously hindsight is 2020, and we can see where they probably didn't do as well, or because I have read criticism of the way the museum is laid out, which I think is fair enough. But there are also beautiful moments, like it has this lovely glass arcade that you walk through, and I don't really think that going around is a grim experience. I think there is a kind of poetry to it. Obviously, it depends on, I guess, whether you're an ally of modernism, but even then, I think, we ought to have these things, and we have these things to debate about, but if we get rid of them, then there's nothing to discuss to begin with.
That's great, thank you. There were some comments down there, I think.
Ken Mackay, architect, Barbican resident for a long time, lived in the area for a very, very, very long time. Can you hear?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. It's a kind of bigger wrap-up question, really. The City of London had the vision after the war to build the Barbican. Nobody's ever told us how much they paid for it or how much they spent on it. But it's social housing. Why can't they do the same again? Why do they have to make a profit out of an office building? Why do they need a developer to come in to do it? It's within their rights to do an amazing piece of housing on the site as part of the extension of the Barbican. And the other thing is they have a housing quota to fill anyway, and they struggle to fill any of it. So it's all off-site, it's all somewhere else. It's, the City of London, I think, should reinvest back in itself. And it's also trying to make the city more accessible for the weekends, the evenings, bring in hotels. You could be a mixed-use hotel, resi scheme, something of that nature. Yeah. Bastion House would convert into a hotel tomorrow. I've done many of them. And that would be very sensible, a different approach to what's been discussed.
I don't think we have anyone from the Corporation of London here. But can anyone give a sense of how they respond to that very pertinent question about
money,
why are you not
first
building housing? Sorry?
Money always comes first. So the City of London is about making money, retaining money, and keeping their freeholds.
Who has the mic over there?
My name's Barnaby. I also moved into the Barbican more or less the same time as you did, about 2.25 years ago. I just wanted to, and I work for the Barbican Quarter Action Group. I'm part of it. I wanted to refute your point about NIMBYism, because I think what's being misunderstood here, in terms of what we're trying to do, is no one has said from our group that these buildings should be preserved in Aspic. Our whole point has been that if we start from the ground upwards and look at the way in which those buildings could be reused, and someone like Tyler could do that, and to be completely honest, the only reason Tyler was able to make a bid for those buildings was because of the work we did. We forced the city into doing a very brief and stupidly kind of curtailed soft marketing exercise to invite people like Tyler in to have a look at those buildings. So that's a very important point.
Thank you.
And also, just on your point of NIMBYism, I think you're slightly guilty of worrying about Smithfield Market, because I think the plans for Smithfield Market are very exciting and they are going to regenerate the area. I love the market. I love cycling through there at 3 o'clock in the morning and seeing the guys in the white coats. It's old. It's out of date. If you live in Golden Lane and have those refrigerated trucks driving down past your front windows at 2 o'clock in the morning.
We have the Linklaters building, we have the Lloyds building. People are complaining about all of those developments. Yeah. So my acquisition of NIMBYism wasn't just about London Wall West. It was about anything that goes around the Barbican.
I think there's a danger that the minute we become activist and begin to fight for anything, we're blamed for NIMBYism. And we have fought very, very hard to make it very clear that what we're open to is reuse of those buildings from the ground up. It involves changes. It involves completely revisioning what those buildings could be used for. Could be a hotel. I'm not an architect, I'm not a developer, I'm a filmmaker, and I work for the Labour Party, so I can talk a little bit about that. But what we've never said what those buildings should be. All we've said is simply demolishing them and creating new office space, and particularly with the aesthetic that's been brought to bear on those new on those designs, is completely inappropriate for that site. And I think that's what the debate is about. And the gentleman who spoke over there about the green agenda is completely right. And I think you're really wrong. We shouldn't be worrying about the carbon cost, but the carbon cost of demolishing those buildings is huge and is irreversible. And I have children and I have grandchildren, and I would be ashamed if I signed my name to demolishing that and creating that damage.
But if I said to you that Bastion House is going to go and we can do a Golden Lane estate on that side, what would you say as a Labour?
I'd say it's bollocks. We can't. The footprint.
But we could.
No. We could retain Bastion House and create social housing. Yeah. If we demolish it, the footprint is tiny.
Well, the City of London, the former Museum of London site is not going to be out.
No. No, I completely agree. But there can be different uses of it. We can create different uses. It can be to do with new startup companies. We were talking to someone last night who works with us, who is a very senior consultant at a financial company, and she was talking about the growth of fintech, the growth of insurance tech. There's all that the city needs to reimagine what its future is, and that's what it's failed to do here. And I think people like Tyler are dead right. We have to make profit from buildings. Developers have to make money, otherwise we go out of business. I make films. If my films don't make profit, I don't get the next one off the ground. So I completely buy that. But the vision has to be completely reimagined.
Hi. Helen, I'm...
Here.
Sorry.
Yep, you go.
Sorry, my name's Garth. I just want to say it's an encouraging move, but at the moment, the City of London had to delay, push off the deadline, partly because they messed up on how they sorted out what they were saying about climate and everything else like that. But what is happening is that they're, at the moment, as I understand it, considering temporary use of Bastion House and the Museum of London, and having said that they were uninhabitable, they're now considering temporary use of that space for the police to use, because there's been a problem with the project which the police are going to move into. So everything's been pushed along. And also for the girls from the Sixth Form College, as I understand it, from the girls' school, which is sited on the Barbican, but them also to move into another part of that. If that happens in a way that somehow dilutes the city's argument that these buildings are unworkable... So
certainly
I think
dilutes the argument that it's about to fall down.
That's absolutely. It's going to fall down. Sorry, I'll be short about this. But the point is that I think that's one thing that people could perhaps seize upon and show that, in fact, if they are going down that line because they've been forced to do it, they've got nowhere to put the police after that, then they should actually try and get the city to accept that it is usable for other purposes.
Any ideas about how that might be capitalised on?
Helen, could I say something, please?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I'm formerly Barbican resident, now Golden Lane Estate. I think one of the things you're slightly missing, and you need the bigger panorama, please, is how the city operates. It's not a borough. It's surrounded by 32 boroughs. It's a unique authority, and it runs in a rather opaque and intransigent way. I'd like the 50 brain power brilliant architects in this room. I've not heard any of you come up with alternative, even wacky ideas, apart from Robert, who said, squatters, not my idea of a solution, but that's a quirky left-field thing. They're visually illiterate, they're very slow, and as Anne said, they're the applicant and they're also the planners. So you're dealing with someone who marks their own homework. If you were faced with this problem and you had a reasonable budget, and I wouldn't give it to Tyler because I don't think he moves quickly enough with the market, but that's my feeling. But if you were faced with that, what ideas would you come up with? I'd like to just hear something, however extreme. Only, I'm not getting that. I'm getting for and against.
Wider ideas. Anyone in the room?
Please.
Yeah, can I have a little go at wider idea? This is Steve again. I would bring in a few people who have raised this aspect of housing and also raised the aspect of Smithfield being an important part of our city. Yes, correct. Smithfield had an unused part, but the other part is kind of alive and well and makes the area. And I agree with Robert. So he'd be part of the team, I think. I think Tyler would probably be part of the team as well, because he, and Ken, and James, because everything could be joined up that way, in my view, because I've had the students look at it, and it isn't necessarily a foregone conclusion that you just sort of demolish or rebuild or you just refurbish alone. The site is 2.5 hectares almost, which is, I think, Barbican is 10 and a bit hectares. Density, Smithfield's smaller, or the bit that's remaining. So the Museum of London Bassingham House Complex, which kind of includes Ironmonger's Hall, which I would argue could be demolished and should be demolished because it's a pastiche, and wasn't originally part of Powell and Moyer's original plans, so they had a more cohesive, coherent kind of plan originally. Anyway, with a 2.5 hectare site, you can get an awful lot of private development. You could get a hotel. You could get a huge chunk of affordable development within there. We've had students testing how Bastion House could be converted, testing how elements of the existing fabric and slabs of the Museum of London can be adapted and built upon. And there's something there to be unlocked, in my view. However, and this goes back to what was being said by yourself there, the City of London works to the rules of exception, i.e. there is no planning. There is no work with others. There is no broader thinking. It's exactly the same as Canary Wharf in the 1980s and the master planning. For those who have, not those who have not.
I'm sorry. I think it's London is a phenomenal city. All right, the city, but also Greater London. It is, in my opinion, the two greatest gateway cities in the world: London and New York. All right. So, and it's progress. The City of London has made some extraordinary progress. It is an engine, whether we like it or not, it is an engine for growth, all right? And it's really important that we think about the businesses that it attracts and the employees, the talent that it brings in and that we produce in this city and this country, all right? And it's the one area that is like actually got a mandate to drive and meet the needs of growth. Now, I've met with planning. Their biggest concern is actually, do they have the buildings to house the growth? And that would be really interesting. Actually, as I said, we've got Gen Z and millennials going to be 68% of office-based employment. And do we want them working from home? Maybe, right? Or do you want to benefit from what has created London in the first place in all central business districts, which is agglomerative economies, bringing people together to collaborate and create greater and bigger and most amazing? And I think London is that. And that is the City of London's mandate, to facilitate and meet the needs of this massive economic engine. It is the one borough that puts that ahead of most other elements. It's not to say it's the only thing, but every other borough is like 35% affordable to 50% affordable for new. There are all these 32 other boroughs are actually focusing on delivering these other things that the city needs. The city needs growth and prosperity and to continue to attract corporations.
Peter Rees, who joined us in the Grony Talk during lockdown, had specifically talked about the big icon buildings, and at the time I think Foster was doing that tulip thing. And I've kind of read about it, and I've looked at the historical kind of planning and land use of the City of London. The cluster's important, yeah? But also other bits of the city are important, i.e. it's not just high rise everywhere.
I'm a councillor in the City of London. However, I represent a fully residential ward. 10% of the city's voters live in the ward of Cripplegate, and we are all residential, despite the impact of the business vote in so many of the 25 other wards. I think your point about we need more office space, you have obviously spoken to the planners, I have too. If you look at we have Destination City as a program to try to bring in people 7 days a week. We have people coming in 3 days a week. If you live there, you see it and you know it. Look at Cheapside, our shopping street. Everything's shut, you know what I mean? It's how, on the Museum of London Bastion Hassett, how does a bulbous office block out of character with what's going on, what the original plan was, so people can come in 3 days a week. It doesn't help the guy selling bagels. We don't need any more Pretz because that's not going to attract the tourist trade that we allegedly want to do when we're all Destination City, bringing in people who are not office workers. Pretz and pubs aren't bringing in millennial office workers as a tourist attraction. So more 3 day a week offices, that's still 4 days a week when no one's there. So looking more creatively at how we use the site for something that is at least wider usage, bringing in people as the museum, and if the new museum site in Smithfield, and if they actually relent and let something more interesting than another office block. I mean, I've lived in the city 30 years. It's been derelict, the Farringdon side of that market, all that time. So I don't think this is like, oh my God, we're saving it. However, I do, as I say, social housing in Bastion House, sign me up. I look at Bastion House. I'm probably one of the only people in here who has a full view of the back of Ironmongers, the back of the museum, and the back of Ironmongers, and Bastion House. Bring me the social housing. They won't do it. If you look at our local plans, oh, it's all windfall. We'll pick it up whenever. We're going to pick it up by social. We're going to pick it up by student housing because 2.5 students counts as one residential dwelling in the city's reckoning. I think it is national guidance, but I don't know. However, there are, yes, people are NIMBYs. They worry about things. Understandably, it is our homes. Most of us just live there. You know, everybody thinks we're the bankers, and we're not. They live somewhere else. So they don't care what goes on in our neighborhood. But development, yes, everything changes. But let's have, you know, did anyone complain about the music center grandiose plans? I don't remember a big campaign against a big-ass building.
You mean
that
the concert
side.
Hall? The
oh, plans. Yeah. There wasn't a huge campaign against that because people said it's a social good. Not a commercial good, back to this gentleman's point. So anyway, there are a lot of things going on. But as I say, the city has to decide, you know, 3 day a week, are we going to be a 3 day a week city? And it's very sad because they're concerned that the net can't cope with the demand for Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. If you know the city, you'll know how grim that is as a thought.
So could Bastion House be a Ned?
Oh, my days. I have 1,000 other ideas that I will come and see you later.
So, okay. So are there any more ideas? I mean, we've talked about hotel. We've talked about, you know, what else could it be? What we talked about reimagining the city. We talked about social housing. What else?
Hello. Hi. I am. My name is Dimitris. I'm an architect and a teacher. We have a unit at UCL. Which has been over the last sort of 4 years exclusively looking at retrofit, teaching students how to work with existing buildings. They vary in typologies. This year we've picked Museum of London as our site, and we try to pick contentious projects every year for that reason. And actually there was some initial mapping and speaking to some of the residents and, you know, with the neighborhood. And actually, you know, schools is actually a problem around the area. There's not enough actually good pub, you know, state schools in the area. There's some you know, private schools, and they are, and there's a problem. And I think, you know, we've been talking a lot about either residential or commercial, and there's actually really other sort of important uses that could be going into the Museum of London. So our unit has been exclusively looking at the Museum of London just because the Baston House is almost too big of a building for them to tackle. You know, they're only sort of undergraduate. But they've come up with, actually, we have 18 students, I think, 14. Okay, that's okay. Some of you more work than others. But they've come up with some amazing kind of projects, you know, and the amount of sort of adaptive reuse that happens with varies, you know, from sort of retrofit to actually, you know, opening up some of that Western kind of wall, introducing the public realm, improving that sort of streetscape and introducing more greenery. You don't need to do that by actually taking the whole building down. You can actually do it through kind of, sort of small, steps, incremental steps. I think, you know, we need to also sort of zoom out and actually understand what are the other uses that make our city's growth, make this London amazing as well. It's not just the, the commercial sector, you know, it's the culture, it's the sort of, you know, it's why, you know, we're also in this part of London as well, right? Because it has sort of the diversity in the culture that has kind of merited and, you know, has become what it is. So I think, we need to broaden the picture about what could be happening in Museum of London. Thanks.
So we're kind of coming to the end of our allotted time. I'm going to ask each of the expert speakers to make some final observations. Robert, could you start?
Final observation is that I think this evening's fantastic because it shows we care. And I think caring about that particular part of London that is now my adopted home and I've fallen in love with is the most important bit. I'm not sure that the City of London Corporation care about it as a place to live because most of them don't live there. I'm not sure that the developers involved care about it as a piece of London. And I think, how are the next generation going to look back upon the decisions that we make now about that area of London? And I'm talking about that area of London in its broadest sense, because I fear that that whole bit is up for grabs. And what do we let it become? Do we let it become a place for Londoners, or do we let it become a place that people make money out of? And that, for me, more than any of the architectural discussions that we've made, is the most important thing. I would like it to be one of the most enjoyable places of London to live, to visit, to come to. And I don't think this office building is going to do that.
Ruth, could you give your final summary?
Can I? Can you? So I think we focus a lot about, like, how we want to have more housing in the City of London. That seems to be a kind of given that everyone wants that. And there's various, as you just alluded to, like various other forms of support of the life in the City of London, which are desperately needed, and worried about how this might be devolved in some way to commercial gains, which are not necessarily feeding into that ecosystem. But I think this is a really important case as a kind of synecdoche of what we're thinking of in terms of the way we reuse buildings and what is and has fallen into a sort of dereliction or is just completely obsolete in the ways that we live in cities these days, and that we really need to start challenging about how we are thinking about and reusing these buildings going forwards. And I think it's really great that there are initiatives that are coming through education, but there's a bubble that's coming through of like students who are really fired up about thinking how we can reuse buildings for different purposes, how we can strip down buildings into component parts and redistribute those into other forms as well, which I suppose is not going to win me any friends with COCO and the 20th Century Society. Like, let's see that those materials be used elsewhere. Like, just strip it like a Haynes manual. Like, there are so many ways that we can win this carbon argument, and I suppose the ideas about embodied carbon, about whether that has a role within the planning system at the moment, is a really key thing, but still has divergent opportunities for us and about how buildings might be developed at the moment. But the key thing really is, what do we want from our cities, and that what voids have been opened up, how we changed and challenged ways of living and working in the city, especially post-COVID, which should be leading a lot more of these decisions rather than focusing down on purely the material aspect of it.
Tyler, I'm going to give you the mic.
Thanks.
I guess closing comments. I am very concerned about the climate crisis, and I think we should all be concerned, and that's why all we've done is refurb. What we have done is infill with mass timber. We started that. We designed that 4 years ago before the London Borough or the London Fire Brigade. They actually objected to it. We had planners object to it. Insurance object to it. That is a really important tool that actually we proposed in Bastion House to pair the one wing with an addition in mass timber. And I do think that that when we talk about the climate crisis, we need solutions, right? That we're not going to stop development, so we need to find more better ways of adopting circular economy strategies and to come up with more sustainable construction methods. And so that's one thing I would say. I would say public policy is about compromise. And as a developer, I go in to meet planners and I go in with an open mind. And in fact, I always start with what do you need and what are your wants before I tell them what my needs are and what I'd like to do. Because it you need to understand and accept that policymakers have an agenda and they've got some objectives. They're driven by, you know, their constituents, and each policy environment has a slightly different objective. I would say, as a stakeholder, you want to approach this in the same way, right? That you want to go in and understand and try to find compromise. And if we can do that, I think instead of it being a either-or scenario, it's a win-win scenario. You don't get everything you want, but you get a little bit of what you want, and that's the way I approach development. It's not just I win, you don't. It's got to be a win-win.
And Jan.
Yeah, absolutely. It's got to be a win-win.
Okay. Of course, planning is about three things: the social, the economical, and the environmental. And so we have to find a balance between those three. In this case, for example, talked about other uses. The girls' school, who's adjacent to the building, has been wanting to expand for many, many years and had made many proposals to expand below the listed Barbican estate. They're desperate for new space. So they're going to take over some space now. The Guildhall School of Music and Drama, also part of the bargain, is desperate to consolidate all their spaces around the site. This is ideal. Now, this city, as the council, should actually do a proper demand study and find out what is required. There are plenty of users. The museum, for example, is right on the site of the historic museum, of the historic Jewish cemetery, of the medieval Jewish cemetery. The Jewish Museum, for example, closed down in Camden in the summer. I mean, what an amazing idea to turn that part of it into the Jewish Museum, where you actually have the graveyard right in the... I'm just saying, well, I talked about the girls' school.
I think as an example, it's a good one.
There are plenty of examples that are already around this site. You just have to look at it very closely. There was a soft market test with at least three credible offers, which offered the city roughly what they wanted to have from the site. They didn't grab it. Instead, went for this office development, which is not going to be a better financial solution.
So I'd like to thank... Thanks, Jan. I'd like to thank everyone who's contributed, all the speakers, and obviously everybody in the room who's given their thoughts. I think the phrase, the dying arguments of a neoliberal model, will haunt me forever. But thank you, everybody, and I hope you found it useful. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. For more on Negroni Talks, visit our website at www.fourthspace.co.uk, where you can see all our past and upcoming events, or find us and subscribe to the show in iTunes. Negroni Talks, mixing it in architecture.